options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Hi, I'm HedgEye's founder, Keith McCullough. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit HedgEye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest.
All right. Good morning. It's game 39 of the 2024 season. It's not year to date. We don't do that. We do cycle to date, but hard to believe it's only 15% of the way through the number of trading days in the current calendar year. I've now eclipsed my 6,000th trading day, which ages me, suffice to say. But welcome to all of you that are new. This is our free access week. It brings back my childhood because we couldn't afford HBO. So I think I'd play hooky and watch that all day. You know, and I'd enjoy it. What I liked about a BLC is that they'd swear. That was cool. What's up?
I think you should get a cake for every 1,000. That's what I think. So someone not getting a cake today is Perigo, ticker PRGO. That's on my long list. They beat the quarter was fine. So 86 versus 83 consensus. Sales were slightly better sequentially, and gross margins were still up 140 basis points, you know, as part of their initiative. But the whole issue is their guidance. They guided 250 to 265. So this is at 301. That's just simply too high. But regardless, it's ended up being sort of a flat year because they said actions taken for the infant formula business. And that, you know, it's been a challenge ever since the whole recall issue. You know, the FDA has just sort of really cracked down on the industry, put sort of extra levels of you know, scrutiny, and, you know, like it's understandable, but it's made the business, they keep having to sort of replicate efforts, and the FDA just doesn't want to have another problem again, right? They were very embarrassed by what happened. So they're taking it out sort of on the industry. Otherwise, if whatever these actions are, which we'll hear in a couple of minutes, the EPS would have been up mid-teens year over year. So I know it's frustrating. The stock's down, you know, I'll have more comments after the call, but, you know, the infant formula, there's not much they can sort of do. The government is the government, right? Like you have a business that's highly regulated in that one aspect, and that's what happens, right? So I'd be a buyer on the weakness, but I want to hear exactly what's going on with the infant formula business. Like, is it like a one and done thing, or is it just, you know, permanently impaired? So that I don't know yet until the call. And then also, the FTC, speaking of the government, that's not something I normally have to do as a Staples analyst. The FTC, no surprise, has filed a lawsuit to prevent the proposed merger between Kroger and Albertsons. That happened yesterday around noon. Kroger actually, you know, it didn't change too much, but it ended up down 2%. And Albertsons was actually up yesterday. So, you know, if you were playing the ARB, Albertsons shouldn't go up, right? Like you should be selling that because you bought it for the merger ARB. So I think that's interesting. Albertsons is on the long list for us. Kroger's on our short list. So we have a great person to ask, the perfect person actually, to ask all these questions that come up when FTC does something like this. And that's Paul Glencher. So we're going to host a flash call today at 12:30. We're going to ask a bunch of questions. I think there's a lot of nuances to this case. And you know, hopefully it'll be helpful to people to size up where to go from here. It affects more than just Kroger and Albertsons, of course, because this would be the largest supermarket merger ever. So, you know, there's a bunch of food retailers that are also impacted if this goes through. So I think that's going to be a good call today at 12:30.
Cool. Appreciate that. My early look note, for those of you that are getting all of the access this week, you're going to see that says the broadening, the squeezing, the mooning. You know, can you do it? Like, I think a lot of crypto is still a fraud, but I'm along it. Can you do that? Try it. Worked. All right. We're not seeing a complete mooning of Chinese exposures, but that would be another one, Jenks, through the lens of our long buy win at the low end of the range last week, which people heard on the call, obviously made the money. But, you know, that would be another big basket that didn't move yesterday. The top three baskets, when I say, you know, broadening, squeezing, and mooning, like the Bitcoin sensitive equity basket was up over 16% on the day. Okay. And this is with the S&P 500 down. It was actually the worst day for Spy Monkey going back to like for a Monday, going back to June. So there's just like some real rip roaring fun going on in there. We're long, of course, Bitcoin and crypto and, you know, related IPOs. That was another thing that took off. But, you know, China just started going again last night. It had to confirm bullish trend and we got that. So LVS, WIN, these names are tethered to that from a factor exposure perspective.
Yep. Yeah. No, they've been, you know, they've been on our long bias list, working to get them moved higher. Now that earnings is wrapping up, we'll be doing more work and eventually maybe getting out there actually this year to do some property tours and re-engage with some of our contacts of old. But anyway, I got three things to talk about. They're not Macau related, but that doesn't mean you can't make money on them, hopefully. So regional gaming out to start. So we put out a note last night, which featured an update of our regional gaming industry revenue model. So January now is in the books. We're less focused on January, but the reality is it came in much weaker, was down low double digits, actually 12.6% year over year, which was below our expectations, even our pared back expectations due to weather. But I think what's interesting there is like what the weekly data implied was that, you know, basically the majority of the softness came in those tougher weather periods. So normally we're a little skeptical about the weather excuses, but in this case, it's justified and or was justified and verified more importantly. So, but I think the bigger takeaway for us is as we look at February and what we can track intra-month, because the month's obviously not done yet, and then what we see on the horizon for Q1 and then the setup into the rest of the first half is, you know, we actually see a setup here where the industry can narrowly accelerate in GGR terms relative to the Q4. And then what that will set up is for Q2, given the easier, much easier comp for Q2 to then accelerate versus Q1. We're talking, you know, these are small growth rates, but like we said in the note last night, growth in this industry is rarely, you know, extraordinary. It's a slower growth industry. It's about margin expansion. And they, you know, this is going to be a better year, importantly, on the cost side. And so the rate of change of things looks up and looks a lot stronger for the domestic regional casinos. Boyd is a name that we've highlighted that we go to. MGM, which continues to be a best idea, is exposed, albeit less exposed. But then Caesars is also a name that's interesting within the context of these trends. So doing more work on other parts of the business, but Boyd and really the space broadly is, you know, we still have sort of a bullish tilt towards that space, and we'll continue to hold that and with this corroborating view on the top line side of things. Over to earnings, wanted to hit on XHR, small hotel REIT that reported, and then NCLH just came out a little bit ago, but I'll run through that. So on XHR, put up a very slight beat of the street, although none of the beat actually came from core operations on the hotel side. Really, they were able to pull a little bit of a corporate expense lever, which ended up driving the slight beat of consensus. I chalk that up for the most part as a fake beat. All that matters really is guidance. And so the midpoint of guidance is about 1.5% above current consensus, a little bit higher than us. But if we rewind back to last year and consider how this company guides, they had a similar guidance, which was, you know, just a little bit above on the midpoint above consensus. And then they proceeded to guide down throughout the year and ultimately missed their initial guidance midpoint by about 2%. The reality is that even with the RevPAR they're guiding to, the cost growth that they're going to have, and really for much of the industry outside of a few hotel companies, is likely going to erode a lot of the potential margin expansion. So margins are going to be down. You're going to have very little EBITDA growth. This is an interesting one because where they're positioned and where they are in the CapEx cycle, they're just not going to have much EBITDA growth to speak of. There's definitely other growthier opportunities in lodging and leisure that we've talked about. But moving on, we won't spend too much time on a $2 billion market cap company. Hitting on NCLH, which is going to have a ramifications and a read through for CCL and RCL, obviously best ideas for us. So NCLH put up an inline Q4, but guidance obviously being a lot more important here. So Q1 guidance actually coming in 40% on the EBITDA line, 40% above current street expectations. And we're basically in line with street for Q1. So 40% above on the Q1 guide, driven by stronger top line guidance, but also on a rare occasion for a company like Norwegian, better cost controls for the Q1, which are driving the range to be nicely above guidance for the full year. However, it's a little bit more in line with what we were expecting out of this company. So they're just 1-2% above the street, roughly similar for us. Does appear that they're going to have some decent cost controls, but the top line looks to be a little softer relative to the other two, which is RCL and CCL. And like I said, the guidance on the top line being more in line with what we were thinking, in that, you know, they're going to have a really solid year, especially on the EBITDA line. It's going to be a real solid pod two acceleration year, but just not nearly as good as what we're going to see out of RCL and CCL. So calls at 10 a.m. I think they're going to have positive read throughs and or commentary, which will have, you know, will be a good read through for RCL and CCL. But NCLH remains our least favorite cruise line with the other two firmly on the best ideas list. So we'll have probably more to say tomorrow after we go through the conference call, and then we'll have all the quarters wrapped up, guidance, all that stuff, and plenty more to discuss. But other than that, that's it for us today.
Professional. Yeah. It's not like it wasn't professional, but XHR, it's like a nothing burger, right? Like, we don't have a position. It's not. Nothing, but so let's just keep it with this, the actionable stuff. Actually, you might disagree, but RCL's back to the signal strength list. That list we actually showed, you wouldn't see that one because it's a relatively recent addition. So we launched that product yesterday in full. You can get that now. We've been
promising. How about that table?
Yeah,
look at that. That sexy table that was aided by the GLL team, working closely with Rob Milburn in the squad.
you just wanted to look nice because your idea is at the top of the list. So
yeah, exactly. If we didn't have enough ideas on there, I would have pawned it off on someone else. No, I'm kidding.
We show the top 10, but there are 60 signal strength longs. That means by definition that it's bullish on both my immediate term trade and trend signal. And again, it shows the amount of days that these names have been on the list. So they're rank ordered, not in terms of old wall conviction, but rank ordered in terms of the time period by which these things have worked. Again, if by definition, if it were mathematical definition, if it were to lose signal strength and break trend, then it would stop working. Okay. So super important list. I've had it obviously on my laptop, desktop, et cetera, for many, 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 many years. But now you get it. And, X one person who's like, they're trying to get me to pay more. I mean, of course we are. I mean, we're working our ass off for you, man. Like,
it's the best. It's going to be the best product. I mean, this is like, if you're going to pay for it, as a guy that like stock ideas, and I think a lot of our subscribers would like stock ideas. Can't think of a better product that rolls it all up into one.
Yeah, and if the analysts, like, you know, like Jenkins is talking about XHR, which I just told him was kind of like, not a lot of value to me, but because it's not on the list, you know, it's not on my signal strength short list. I mean, what I find value, and again, you should overvalue, are ideas that the signal agrees with the analyst. You know, do that, right? Because analysts get things wrong, and so does the signal, but the signal gets it wrong less. Just FYI. All right, Brian.
Yeah, good morning. So we got a lot going on this morning. We'll try to be quick. Me and Jeremy will tag team some earnings. First is Carter's, CRI. This is a name we went long 2 weeks ago. The company came out and they beat the quarter. They guided down 1Q. That's what this company does. They're a beaten guide down company. So what you got to do is look at the earnings algorithm. Are earnings accelerating or decelerating? That's the thing I really care about. And earnings here are accelerating. So they were up 10% in 3Q, up 21% in 4Q. And the reason why we added it to our list is we think earnings are accelerating. It happens to look good on signal strength. And you have Children's Place, which is a key competitor, where its stores are probably being cut in half. The stock has been very volatile, Children's Place. It's probably not going away, but it will be cut in half. You have some favorable secular trends, like a leveling out in the birth rate, which has been on a 10-year decline. So we are bullish on Carter's. Stock's trading up here this morning. Hope our viewers added that a couple of weeks ago when
well,
we did.
An example of like where, you know, so on the signal strength product, it's either going to say Brian McGough has it as a best idea. Brian McGough has, actually, you can rattle this up. But I mean, the ones that as soon as Brian mentioned Carter's, I popped it in the machine and it signaled bullish trade and trend. So it was on my signal strength list. And he said he had more work to do. So you don't have to wait. You don't have to wait for the analysts to go comb their hair and brush, you know, and brush their teeth. You can buy it, right? You can do this. I would, or it wouldn't go on the signal strength list. So, and then eventually, and it didn't take long. I think it took like literally a couple of days. But then Brian put it on his bench. Now, you know, it moves up, you know, wherever it moves. But that's super important because that is a bottleneck, right? There's a bottleneck between analysts doing the full process work, building out a full model. And the signal. It's always a race between the signal and the analyst, right? The alternative for all of you, and good morning, drawdown Josh Brown. Good morning, buddy. You know, you got the alternative is you actually don't have a bottleneck because you never model anything and you have no process. You just talk, right? There's no bottleneck to that. There's just talking, you know? So that's the alternative. If you guys want to, after this free week is over, go back to that, then you know, eat your heart out. That's what I have to say about that. You got anything to add to that, Brian?
No, nothing to add. I like it. I think it is a race. It is like we're always trying to edge each other out, and complement each other. So it's all good. So just,
and by the way, I didn't mean me against you. I meant the market, which is my signal against you. Right.
Yeah.
It wasn't like Carter's didn't have news. I mean, there's, you know, you were talking about something fundamentally that was, you know, from a market share perspective that was shifting, and that's, you know, the buy side's sitting there reading that. They're listening to the call. They're not going to wait.
Yep. They don't like waiting, Keith. I just another name I want to touch on real quick is Macy's. It's acting like it's not being acquired. So the only reason why you're invested in Macy's right now, which I am not, is that you think it's going to be bought out. There's all these rumors which are circulating about these bids which are coming in. The company beat the quarter, which is good. It did 245 versus the street at 198, but it took a massive guide down in 1Q. Dillard's last night also put out earnings below last year, and that stock is up on a rope. If I had to do something, which I don't, I would probably short Dillard's. But Macy's is closing 150 stores. I'm saying that slowly just so it sinks in for people. I mean, this company has 507 stores. It's closing 150 of them. What the hell does that tell you? I mean, it's just like shrinking itself into obsolescence. So this is bearish for Nordstrom, JWN. Which is a best idea short of ours. This thing is it probably has very good signal strength, not on the short side, but on the long side. It's been trading up, but the news out of the department stores over the past 12 hours is not favorable for Nordstrom JWN. And then I'll just pass it over to Jeremy to hit real quickly on Lowe's, AutoZone, and LAD. Well. Longs and shorts.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, so I'll start with Lowe's, LOW. We talked about this one yesterday, but best idea short reported generally in line, but guided down comps and earnings for the year as we expected. So comps of -2 to -3 versus the street at -1.5%. EPS about 5% below the street, midpoint of 12.15. The street was at about 12.70. And, you know, we see another 50 cents or so in downside to the earnings. So much like Home Depot, I think this is one where we have, you know, a stock that's at a peak multiple with negative growth and further EPS risk. So that's kind of a tight spot for us, given, you know, the rate of change is probably not going to get worse. Again, I'm not sure it's going to get much better, but unlikely to get worse. So we'll keep working through the model and see if anything changes in our general thesis there. But still see risk to, you know, the comp and earnings trajectory over the next, you know, few quarters. AZO is a long biased name. So we added this and O'Reilly, O-R-L-Y, to our long list at the start of the year. And the crux of the call here is that the auto parts space had some of the most doable earnings numbers. And, you know, we have this aging auto fleet, tight supply, low affordability, you know, means tailwinds to maintenance demand over the near term. So the company came out, beat earnings, revenue is in line, but earnings of about 2890 versus street at 2630. So, you know, we're seeing that upside to the numbers on earnings that we thought we would. And we think the demand elements continue to support investment in current vehicles, you know, for the average consumer. So tailwinds to their demand continues. And then the last one is LAD. So this is the best idea short. That's Lithia Motors. They acquired Carousel Motor Group. So that's the projected revenue here is $900 million. They didn't give the deal price. We'll probably find that out later, I assume, in a Q or K. But the deal here is interesting because, you know, we've been flagging the risk around their acquisition strategy, right? They've been very aggressive in buying other dealers when the industry has been over earning so much, right? And we have a lot of risk in terms of where demand and margins will go in the auto space. And we actually heard some investors talking about their conversations with management that they're kind of hinting they'd shift more capital allocation to like stock buyback versus M&A over the near term to sort of, you know, de-risk that part of the thesis. Well, then they came out here and did a very sizable M&A deal. So it looks like their strategy is still to buy their growth at whatever price they can find and, you know, pressure the balance sheet and where we think this is a dangerous time to be doing that. So LAD is the best idea short. This action is in support of what we think is the risk around the equity of, you know, overly aggressive M&A strategy in a declining used and new auto market. So that's all I got. And unless you have questions, Keith.
Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Hope you're enjoying our podcast. Start generating alpha with our suite of Sector Pro investing research products. Dive deep into retail, industrials, technology, and everything in between with exclusive access to the sharpest analysts and actionable ideas on Wall Street. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Keith, you're on mute. I'll just close with Beyond, BYON. This stock ripped yesterday. It's got great signal strength. It's got accelerating pod one, pod two, pod three. We're doing a call in the studio with the chairman of the company, who's the change agent, on Friday. If you're a subscriber to Retail Pro, you'll get access to that. The stock interestingly ripped after it hit the tape a few hours after trading and a few hours after people on the call heard that we moved it to a best idea, what we did. So another incentive to listen to the call. And that's all I got.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. There's the, you know, it's timely, topical. If you're doing the work, you earn the opportunity to, you know, to get to go first, right, on the bid. If you're looking to buy something, that's definitely a competitive advantage of the call. But another big one is just understanding, like, as you know, as we're shifting in sector. I mean, you know, we're old enough to remember the bear market in your sector that barely has ended. You know, a bunch of yo-yos or Muppets on CNBC or people that are listening to this just to check it out, or, you know, they're like, oh, my God, you know, they've been bearish on a SPY. Or it's like, you're so bad at this. I can't spend any more minutes on it. But what we're trying to do is get you into the right sector styles, factor exposures. And if you don't know what those are, let's just start with that. If you're not playing at that level, get there. And then getting into the single stocks. And all we, you know, we really care about is making these pivots. Brian had like 70 shorts that have worked all the way through last year. Right. So you can think whatever you need to think. But the fact of the matter is what's in our accounts is what matters the most. So Brian making the turn on this long. I mean, obviously, when he goes bullish, people are going to pay attention because he's been bearish for a while, and accurately so. So I'm not surprised at all, Brian, that that stock had that reaction.
Yeah. I was happy to see it. A lot more to go.
I mean, we have U.S. retail and apparel stocks were down 60, 70, 80%. I mean, during the quote-unquote bull market of 2023, don't forget, because the Russell 2000 remained in a bear market, and so did most small and mid-caps. So again, let's just get better. You know, if you can't afford this next week, I get that. Work harder, and then maybe you will. And if you can, then you're going to understand this is a much better way. Okay? Thank you. Tom?
Well, to your... to what we were just talking about with Jenkins and Brian, just on Patterson, I was in your inbox over the weekend on sort of what was screening short on the quad factor signal, system we built out, trying to lean into and capture, that quad alpha and say, okay, from the 400 and some odd names, how do I narrow it down to the ones that have a high probability, short or, long bias, sort of a probability on a week-to-week basis, and Patterson has been sticking out here. Second piece was the signal strength, which you flagged, and then last couple of days, I've got a pretty robust, essentially clerical process that looks through their internal growth rate versus, probably scanning across maybe 10 or 12 meaningful time series that are within the healthcare macro set. So something like quantity index for dental services, employment of dental offices, vet and dental, any type of consumption metrics. A lot of those are actually survey-based. So they have high correlation. So test them for correlation, test them for, what's happening in the current quarter and going forward. And then other stuff like cell phone data, so into and out of a large number of dental offices and vet clinics and this, that, and the other thing. So, having run through all that process, getting down to, where does the top line sit? What's the recent history here? Read through a couple of the transcripts. I think the thing's going to trade back down into the low 20s. They basically missed and guided slightly lower into the second half on their fiscal second quarter. And they've talked about the second half being okay, that they have some leverage to pull, some top lines can be okay. But what I'm seeing is vet and dental continue to really remain weak. And if I run that through the model, 20% type gross margin business, there's a lot of negative leverage on the operating side down to the EBITDA and operating profit and EPS basis. If you run that through, here's a name that trades at 9x, low teens EPS, PE type basis, but 9x on the EBITDA basis. Could it trade back down into the 7.5, 8? Yeah. I mean, that's not unreasonable, particularly if I take that weakness and extend it through 2025, ending June, right? So there's a lot to do here. The problem is that I pushed this to you on Sunday. I got most of the work done yesterday and last night, put this note out a few minutes ago, and they report tomorrow morning. I'd say on a shorting it here today into the print, that I mean, I just wrote that. So I think that's a good idea. But, the extensiveness of the weakness that I'm seeing in these other time series, I actually wouldn't be super unhappy if I get the print. It's not as bad. The stock doesn't really trade down or trades up a little bit, because I think this is really going to be more about, if they maintain the guidance and you get into the second half, March and the June quarter, it's really about 2025. So in terms of where that multiple is going to land and where I'm going to get most of the delta. But that's it. So Patterson short as of 10 minutes ago. That's it.
10 minutes. All right, Emily.
Good morning, Keith. I just want to, a news item relative to the drug channel. Change Healthcare, which is a Nashville company here, was acquired by United Health over the, I think, heartburn at the Federal Trade Commission, but there wasn't much they could do about it. Change Healthcare's claim to fame going back really in the 1990s was, when it was called something completely different, was to develop a very streamlined claim system for the drug channel. akin to swiping your credit card, you know, so that there is a near real time exchange of information and exchange of payment, which is very different from the healthcare industry at large, which in some cases still relies on fax machines or what they call electronic fax machines. Change Healthcare has been seized by a cyber attack for about 4 days, which will affect the claims processing and therefore the claims numbers and both the scripts and the revenue at the pharmacy level, particularly for the really large guys like CVS and Walgreens. The attack has been linked to a group in Russia, which I assume is trying to make a geopolitical point about the Ukraine and NATO, but they also get, in the bargain, access to a lot of personal health information, which allows for a lot of fraud. When personal health information, specifics about patients and the prescriptions that they get, they pay for, additional claims could be filed, fraudulent claims could be filed that can go undetected. And this has been a real big part of the whole cyber strategy, because it funds, you know, certain geopolitical activities that are outside the pay grade of your health policy analyst. But this is important, and it's going to draw attention to the fact that the level of consolidation in the claims processing industry, and particularly in the insurance industry, it's not what everybody thinks it is, but this is the kind of thing that causes concern at the federal antitrust level. So that's it.
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Agile. Join our entire research analyst team live before the market opens for a deep dive investing analysis, our favorite stock ideas, and our risk manager in chief, Keith McCullough's macro overlay. Our team of 40 plus equity analysts discuss key market developments, trends, and our high conviction long and short investing ideas. You will not get this granular level of insight anywhere else. A video replay, audio version, and analyst summary notes from the call are available shortly after each live show to ensure you don't miss anything. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe and tune in live to the call weekdays at 7:45 a.m. Eastern. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Another thing you're going to learn on the call, it's not just about stock picks, even though last week Emily had a great one with Moderna, was at the top end of the range. I said the signal was there to sell it. She said, I listened to the call, read the transcript, whatever, sell it. You know, maybe one day she makes you money. Maybe the next day she tells you, call your congressman about fraud in America. I mean, I think both are of value, by the way. Flipping that to Steiner, I mean, on the one hand, like knowingly long fraud and market manipulation and the machine's flow. I wrote that this morning and I said it. I mean, if some of you have like moral authority over that, then I totally get that. I mean, what I'm trying to do is say, if you don't understand how manipulated crypto is into month end, you don't know crypto. I mean, you don't know. So of course I'm going to be long it into month end. I'm not going to like just give up free money. You know, when something's signaling higher highs, higher lows within the risk range signal on a bullish trend breakout, which started on February the 5th, Steiner, I mean, I don't hold any moral high ground over being long IBIT, which is the new Bitcoin ETF.
Yeah. Good morning. With respect to crypto, I mean, look, I think the signal has been rails there. There's no question. And I think, look, there's a few things we know about crypto, right? We know one, that it's a very high volatility asset class. Two, we believe that there are some very real projects, just as truthfully as there are some very fraudulent projects. And we know that cycle, and the crypto cycle is no different. And we'll see all the new frauds eventually when the tide goes out over this next cycle. But at this point, we're sort of at the beginning or early stages of this next cycle. So It's making for some very interesting dynamics on the long side. And obviously, the signal is sort of the key guide there. Fundamentally, we'll have much more to say on crypto in the not too distant future. So I guess stay tuned for that. As for me, just kind of back in the saddle here after being offline a little bit, but this.
By the way, he's alluding to, we hired a new crypto analyst. His name's Ish, who's getting ready to launch. That's what you meant by that, just to be clear.
Yep. Yep. So we'll have a new digital assets research vertical coming relatively soon. And then on the
finish. Yes, we have all digital assets. That's what you have to call it to circumvent certain fraudy stuff. Okay. There's a lot to this. I interrupted you twice, sir. Go ahead.
No, that's fine.
It's your first day back. Actually,
people might be amused to know the reason we're calling it digital assets. It's because internally we've been advised that second only to the word Viagra, email spam filters capture the word crypto. So it's almost impossible to send out research with the word crypto in it and have it actually make it to its intended destination. So digital assets is going to be the term moving forward for us. We'd like to be able to get our research actually to people. So anyway, that's why I'll be calling it digital assets. We are this Thursday at 12:30 going to be hosting a black book on the financial side. It's going to be an updated outlook on consumer credit relative to all of the credit card companies, really the broader consumer finance landscape. Obviously, great timing, right? When I went out for a little bit here, there was a massive merger announced in the space, Discover being acquired by similar company, larger company, but very similar in many ways, Capital One. There's a lot of synergistic reasons, rationales underpinning that deal. We'll get into a lot of that. We'll get into kind of some of the interesting nuance around both the strategic motivations, but also the timing. We'll cover a lot of that. There's also in the short term, and I believe Dragos touched on this in my absence, but there's a very significant negative catalyst in the space basically looming here in the short term, which is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, is set to issue a rulemaking decision on late fees, and more specifically, potentially capping them in the credit card space, which would effectively or could effectively reduce late fees by about 75%. And for some of these companies, Capital One and Discover kind of right in the bullseye, this is a very significant source of revenue, and this ruling by the CFPB could and likely will have very significant downside implications. So you have a very interesting sort of cross-current dynamic in the short, intermediate, and longer term here. We'll cover all of that, as well as obviously the broader macro, how it's evolving, and so forth. So that call will be this Thursday at 12:30. That's kind of our primary short-term focus. It's getting ready for that. Outside of that, very briefly, we do this week have Canadian earnings, Canadian bank earnings. So this morning we got numbers from Bank Montreal, BMO, as well as Bank of Nova Scotia, Scotiabank, BNS. To very quickly recap, Bank Montreal, BMO, they missed on earnings. Earnings were down 16% year over year. It was really a pretty across the board miss. NII or net interest income missed, non-interest income missed, provision expense missed, and operating expenses missed. So basically a clean sweep by them. On the Scotiabank or BNS side, more mixed. They beat on earnings, although earnings for them were down 8%. Year over year versus BMO's being down 16% year over year. They did beat on both revenue lines, NII and non-interest income. Where they missed was on both operating expenses and provision expenses. So we'll get more Canadian bank earnings. Tomorrow we get National Bank and Royal Bank. And Thursday we'll get CIBC and TD. And that's it for me this morning.
I'm sure that's just riveting for people who are trying to trade Workday today. We do it all. Like, we don't, we do boring. We do exciting. When something gets exciting, by the way, that's generally not a good thing. What you want is the volatility of the asset class to fall, not break out. And that's actually helped crypto going full circle, and Bitcoin in particular. We're in the first or third percentile of the last 3 months of volatility. That's why a major reason on our signal why it broke out, of course, because our signal is volatility adjusted. We call that our VASP, or our volatility adjusted signaling process, right? No moving monkeys allowed unless for observational purpose. Feed them some bananas. It's holding the 50-day. Well, great. Thanks for coming out. All right. It's 1990 all over again with that. Rob, good morning. You got we had a buy and a sell in real-time alerts. So everybody knows what the sell is. It's one of the greatest shorts in the history of red lights, you know. But we had some green lights. We had talk about boring. Like, FR is the ticker. First Industrial Realty. I love that.
Yeah, it's funny. That takes me back about 3 years to when I first started. Actually, Howard said something to me when I came to HedgeEye. He's like, "Oh, I always thought REITs were really boring. Like, you talk about some really interesting, weird stuff." And I'm like, "Well, you know, they're supposed to be boring, but many of them are not." I mean, if they're not, like you said, if they're not boring, that's in my space, in my world, that's a really, really big problem.
What is, like, you know, we want to be long cyclical growth as the bottom of the cycle finds itself here into the second quarter, which, you know, once you hit quad two in May, you know, industrials are along right now. Real estate isn't in particular, but this is like, you know, the word industrial is even in their bloody name.
Hi, I'm Keith McCullough, and I wanted to introduce you to my favorite product at HedgeEye, the Macro Show. Why is it my favorite product? Well, it's my show. I do that every morning. If you want to get ready for the market day, you want to contextualize all the data, you want to make good decisions, then this is what you should be watching. It's a repeatable process that you can deliberately study, measuring and mapping time series to time series of data. So it's not going headline to headline and getting whipped around. It's actually being so much more dispassionate about it and making good decisions that are data driven. So we'd love to have you on our team. Come join us.
Tune in weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern and on demand anytime. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe.
Well, yeah, I mean, at least historically, you know, industrial, like, really what industrial REITs are now are logistics REITs. They buy and own warehouses that essentially, like, house inventory and parts along the distribution chain for e-commerce. So the business has morphed. Historically, it was very levered to, it was very correlated with GDP growth, the ISM, you know, like any of these macro indicators, and it kind of, like, detached from that. Like manufacturing and industrial activity macro indicators, and it detached to that and became much more of like a consumer consumption driven sector. So it's mm-hmm. morphed over time, and industrial is kind of maybe a misnomer at this point. It's really more logistics. But yeah, I mean, you know, the machine may not pick it up that way. And really in this company's case, they've already taken their occupancy hit. So they're among one of the logistics REITs that spec builds, and they put a lot of shovels in the ground going into the slowdown. You know, if you recall, it's 2 years ago now. So in 2022, in early 2022, basically Prologis started talking about, and Amazon started talking about Amazon's leasing slowdown. And that really, like, caused people to dial back their growth expectations. And in FR's case, they had put a bunch of shovels in the ground in projects that they expected to lease during the build out period. And in some cases that happened, in other cases it didn't. And so what happened was they basically delivered a bunch of vacant or quasi vacant buildings into their portfolio, which when that happens, it drops in, it's an immediate occupancy hit, right? And so, like, they've taken the occupancy hit up front, and this is now one of the names, in addition to just, you know, regular way compounded rent growth, there's occupancy upside. which is kind of hard to find in that space. So that's like the longer term bull case here. And it's, you know, look, is it like one quarter or two quarters out? I don't know, but I'm fairly confident we're going to wake up a year and a half from now. And like, you're talking probably 200 to 300 basis points of pickup there and like a 7 to 8% compounder, which is on an unlevered basis, which is exactly what you kind of want to look for in my space.
Well summarized. I like that. It is. I mean, it is exciting. Like when you can get an education like this, I mean, your sector is one of the toughest ones for amateurs to understand. I mean, I'm an amateur in real estate, so don't get your hair in a knot here this morning. If you don't have hair, don't get prickly with me. I'm trying to learn just like you are. Yeah, like so that's why we're listening to Rob. What else you got?
Yeah, so yesterday I did a black book on AHR, American Healthcare REIT. First long black book in probably 2.5 years. So, you know, we do longs too. And it's the only long that we have in the healthcare REIT side. I'm very like, and I mentioned this yesterday in the video, I find it like kind of challenging to find long ideas in healthcare because there's this very, well, I mean, you know, we've gone through a litany of issues over the last 2 years, but there's this very kind of like fraught relationship in many cases between, you know, the landlord and the lessee in the case of triple net lease properties. And, you know, the pace of compounding on lease escalators tends to outpace the tenant's, you know, ability to cover that lease in many cases. And so it's tricky. Like you have to be careful. In AHR's case, and this is a recent IPO about three weeks ago now, they have more of a what's called a SHOP. Or SHOP stands for Seniors Housing Operating Properties, or RIDEA. And without getting too, RIDEA is just like a tax structure, but without getting too technical, it allows for the REIT, instead of participating in rent, to own the EBITDA or the cash flow after rent, as though it like owned and operated the asset. And so like, if you think about that, for a space that's still recovering from like, you know, post-COVID trough occupancies, if you have a fair amount of SHOP exposure, your like NOI is more, there's just more operating leverage to the upside. And when you look across the space, like Welltower, Ventas, et cetera, they're more expensive versions of names that have a lot of SHOP exposure. This one comes out of the gate. It's got a really interesting story and it's under leased and cheaper than the rest. Like I see a rate of change acceleration plus a more like interesting valuation. So it's just an interesting, stealthy new way to play it that's unseasoned and, you know, needs to grow into its cost of capital, but it's set up very nicely to do so. So we have it on the long side and talked about it yesterday.
And not well known. Again, that's another thing you're going to find on the call. Again, those two long ideas in particular today, you know, eat your heart out and short MPW against it. It's right near the top end of its range if you want to hedge the real estate factor or fraud factor exposure. And yeah, the fraud, you can hedge fraud a lot of different ways. MPW is one of my faves. All right. Thank you. Well done. Jay is in London with institutional clients in meetings. So I'll go to Freebird. Are you on?
Yep. I'm here. So when I said there's never a dull day in Complan, I meant it. So yesterday, the headlines hit that Charter was looking to potentially acquire Altice, which is hilarious if true, and frankly, just way too poetic for it to be reality. So I'm a little skeptical. But what I assume is happening here is Altice is shopping themselves around in an attempt to stave off a potential bankruptcy, because I do think that's ultimately where this one's headed. And it's also a really, really bearish sign for Charter, especially in light of recent broadband losses, because the only reason Charter would do a deal to acquire Altice is if they were really concerned about their ability to grow broadband subscribers, and they were basically looking at a hole to fill, especially given the potential for higher churn related to ACP customer losses and the fact that they just missed this last quarter. So for Altice, there are two footprints here to consider, the East and the West. The East is Southwestern Connecticut, New York City, and Long Island. And the West is Texas, Arizona, and a smattering of other states. And the West is the former Suddenlink footprint that they acquired years ago. And that's probably one of the worst cable assets out there in the United States. They've underinvested in a very long time. They haven't upgraded to the newest forms of DOCSIS. They've been losing share to fiber and fixed wireless. So it's just been pretty much an unmitigated disaster over there. And when I look at Altice, again, looking at a per valuing on a per passing basis, I just don't think the assets are worth anything more than the current debt. Now, could Charter come in, refinance the debt, reterm it out, and try to capture some synergies here? Maybe, but that doesn't change the fact that they would be acquiring inferior cable assets, and even Altice's fiber network that they've been growing isn't in line with Charter's own CapEx strategy, which is not fiber. So I'm not really sure there would be as many synergies here as you would really need to have in order to make the deal work financially. And then even at the end of the day, if they were to do this, they would have to either issue equity or debt to finance it. And then you're looking at a company that on a pro forma basis would probably be trading closer to 5x leverage. And it doesn't really solve any of their problems, which is an oversaturated market, declining broadband penetration rates, competition from fiber. So like I said, it's like, you know, you tie two rocks together, they're still going to sink and they're probably going to sink faster. So we'll see if anything comes of this, but it was definitely interesting. So still short Charter. Just to be frank here, I'd actually be surprised that the deal goes through. I put the probabilities at probably 30% or less, 20 to 30%, because I just don't know if I guess Charter is kind of been delusional these days in terms of how management's been thinking about the market. So maybe they do look at this and think it's a good deal. But I just don't think, I just don't think that the probabilities favor this actually happening. So take that for what it's worth as relates to Altice and the fact that I think that if a deal doesn't happen, it's probably a bankrupt company.
I mean, you also have the dynamics of market manipulation, right? Altice is no stranger to certain hedge funds and manipulations and ownership. I mean, right into month end, of course, right? I mean, there's the rumor and voila. But, boom. You know, we live in a country where nobody goes to jail for these things. So, I mean, it really is part of a dream that I have for the call and for Hedgeye Nation and all of you as a community. Is that we become, much more of a reinforcing police of this type of behavior. I mean, it's happening, right? So the more people that are watching the call, the more people that are talking about it, the less they're allowed to do it out loud, And I think that that's a huge service to the public that we'll provide that CNBC will never provide. CNBC has not mentioned MPW's, activities or behavior one time, right? Yeah. They did mention Lynn Energy when it was going to zero because they were trying to suggest that we were being bad people or something about the research. So huge opportunity, right? To open up as the hedge eyes would open your eyes, have some transparency and accountability to the whole shooting match. That one, that's why Andrew and I were chuckling back and forth with each other and why I chuckled this morning. Now on Google, I don't know if you read my early look, but this isn't the first time that an AI related headline has whacked it, but it is the first time that it's whacked it below trend, and you do see that dynamic. Like yesterday I wrote it's Mag 5, not Mag 7, because, and we talked about it on the call, because Apple's not an AI play, neither is Tesla essentially. So if you were to start to really like a Dumbo, put a big circus tent over it, like the clowns on CNBC would, and you think that's all that matters to Google's business, well, maybe it would break trend. I don't know. Like I wrote this morning, I don't know why, I don't care why, but if it breaks trend, it's a tangible event in my process from a risk management perspective.
Yeah. And I would say, whenever, I pay very close attention to signals, obviously, and whenever something changes and the signal's saying something, it always forces me to go back, to see if I'm wrong, right? If I'm missing something. And there's two things here for Google where other than the data just steering us wrong, the data being wrong, right? Which the data has been more right than wrong. There are two factors, there are two variables to consider that, could result in earnings and cash flow coming in lower. And that would be one, the primary one would just be that the launch of Gemini is resulting in a higher rate of expenses and that they're not managing those expenses effectively relative to headcount. And therefore, margins aren't going to continue to improve and earnings estimates are either going to stay where they are or they're very likely go down. That's what the stock going down would imply, right? If it were to continue to go to lower. The other factor here is the antitrust piece, which Paul's talked about, where there's still a series of high profile court cases that are occurring through, I think May and September are going to be big months for the antitrust trials as it relates to Google's search relationship with Apple and then the ad tech case that fires up later this year. So there could be some, overhang and uncertainty related to that that's weighing on the multiple. but as far as the core search business goes, the data continues to look fine. So I'm inclined to kind of overweight that as I have been. And then I would just say that, it's these names are always kind of get caught up in like the cultural zeitgeist, right, of all everything. And without kind of going down that path, I would just say Google, it's not a question in my mind of whether or not Google has the moat or the technological capability to compete. I think the issue here is, and has been for a while, is a culture, one of culture and one of leadership. I've been on the record saying that I think that Sundar's days as CEO are probably numbered going back months now for that reason. And that there needs to be another, a shot of life injected into the company to kind of really get everyone moving in the right direction from a product development standpoint and also from a sales standpoint. So we'll see. It's not likely to happen. I don't think that would be a change of leadership is not likely to happen until these antitrust cases are over, right? Like it's very unlikely that the board is going to fire the CEO and the CEO is going to leave in the midst of that. It's just a bad look. And I'm not sure that would be the best outcome. But I do think that we're clearly on a path to that. But they have to deliver and they have to deliver numbers, right? Which I think they will do. But it may not just be to the magnitude to get, it's not going to be a Meta, at least in the very, very short term. Because they just haven't cut costs as much. But I think that's definitely on the table over kind of a 9 to 12 month duration. Like we have to get past these antitrust cases before we could really start to see Google move very aggressively in that direction.
Yeah, and that's embedded in my in signal as well. So you can see that today. Also, you can see an explanation of the signaling process in the early look. My challenge every day is to coach the process. It's not to understand what to do with the process. That's me playing the game. There's a difference between being a player and a coach, which I have a very humble level of awareness on in the last couple of years. If you look at Meta's signal today, which you can find in the momentum tracker, you'd see in our risk range product, it signaled a higher high and a higher low in the risk range, which is very bullish, while Google broke down. So what if you were to separate that using a simple example of a developing factor exposure, which is antitrust, you'd say the signal assigns more risk to Apple and Google on antitrust than it does to Meta. And that's just it. I mean, if you really need to know why, but again, like I say, I don't start with why, I start with when. Like when that happens, I assume that the market's smarter than me. Whereas most people on CNBC, in particular on the Mag 4 or 5 now, they know everything about everything all the time, which is an amazing thing. No analysts, no models, no trackers, no nothing, right? And Friedman's sitting here saying, hey, look, I'm looking at my Google tracker. It looks fine. They don't have anything. It's an amazing thing to watch. And it's only really in bull markets and bubbles that people will behave this way and really believe their own bullshit. But, you know, we try to fade ourselves on that. That was very good, Andrew. Thank you for that. Go to, I don't see Nick. Felix?
Hey, man. Two things. So when I was at CES earlier this year, one of the more popular leading edge technologies that I was very impressed about was transparent TVs. And that was showcased by Samsung and LG. Well,
what's that?
Did you say something?
Yeah, what's that? What's a transparent TV?
Oh, it's just using very cutting-edge technology like micro-LEDs. You basically can see through the TV. Like, in other words, you can see visuals, but you can also see the background. It's very cool. But my point is, at the ongoing Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, that's the biggest conference right now, Lenovo unveiled a transparent display laptop where there is a screen you can see through along with a transparent keyboard. I looked at the design video. It's very cool. I think designers and creators will love it with their bright screens. They also have a camera that can be used to identify objects behind the screen display and show information about that object's identification information. So they're using various technology and also Gen AI to basically have more innovative features for the laptop. Overall, pretty cool software, pretty cool hardware. It's a concept model, so you can't buy it yet, but this is something very futuristic and exciting to see. So that's one thing. Second, I want to mention it's interesting that Microsoft is taking a minority stake in a French AI LLM developer called Mistral. This is interesting because, you know, seems like Microsoft is giving more options to its Azure customers other than OpenAI. And we expect Microsoft to continue to invest in various AI startups as it aims to be the world AI software leader. So I wanted to just mention that. That's it.
Yeah, Microsoft, back to the wrist range signal, again, you got to call it for what it is. There's been a deterioration in the Mag 7 because now it's Mag 5 app because you subtract Apple, which is your short, and Tesla, of course, which is Jay Van Sciver's short. He's the guy who's in London, for those of you that are new to this. And then you got Google teetering. But Microsoft, first time it signaled a lower high, Felix. Now that is either one of two things. It's a consolidation signal. In other words, the broad market and Microsoft get it. It's called exhaustion signal, where it's done going up for now and it consolidates at higher lows and starts to take off again sometime down the line, like in 3 or 4 weeks or something like that. We'll have to see. But it's a call out nevertheless. Looking back as I wrote this morning on markets, this is more of a point for everyone. I was using Admiral McRaven, William McRaven, who was the longest standing Navy SEAL. I'd probably go with him instead of like some of these clowns on the clown network. But you know what he said was like, your easiest day was yesterday. You know that in markets, right? Like, you know, whoever is commenting on markets, it's very easy to comment on what happened after it happened. I mean, that's the easiest day, is to look back on yesterday. For me to tell you that, you know, Bitcoin went up and the crypto basket squeezed for a 16% move and the rolling highest short interest basket at Goldman was up 4% and our IPO basket was up 3%, that's easy to see. It happened. The hardest thing to do is your job today, right? It's to do the job every fucking day with discipline, every day. And that's a really hard thing to do. That's why people want shortcuts. That's why they want clowns. That's why they want belief systems and laser eyes, because it's hard. It's hard to do the job. I'm seeing less and less people do the job, by the way, on all the channels of communications that we have in social media. A lot of people have just kind of like given up on doing the real work, which is great because we're just getting started. All right. Paul, on the antitrust point, did you have any thoughts that were coming to mind other than what you've articulated?
With respect to Google, you mean?
Yeah, like that. I mean, and did I tie, like, these aren't two rocks that'll sing together. I mean, I didn't want to trivialize it and say it's, you know, that Google and Apple go over here and Meta go over there. I'm just saying that that's what my signal did yesterday.
Your signal, I think, is correct on that because it is reflecting the substantive reality beneath the surface, which is I do think that Google's vulnerable in that the whole thing about whether they can have this default arrangement to make, you know, Google the default search on Apple devices. You know, that potentially is going to go negative for Google with implications on Apple. We've talked about that. And also the ad tech case, you know, initially there seems to be a reasonable amount of strength to that DOJ case. That's going to be litigated in September. At least that's the tentative date to start that. And that would mean potentially some, you know, a risk of divestiture of the DoubleClick acquisition or some other potential remedies that people are going to have to worry about when this thing gets going in the fall. So that's hanging out there. And I agree. The Meta situation, Facebook, you know, there is an antitrust case against them too, which is the FTC trying to force the divestiture of Instagram. I think that's a loser. And I think the judge is not real sympathetic to what the FTC is doing in that case. It's going to go forward. They're trying to push a trial this year, but I don't think the odds of the FTC prevailing there are very good. So to the extent your signal is reflecting that, that is the underlying substantive reality of what's going on in those cases.
So unless you're in Florida where it's like always golf season, you can go tell your buddies today, hey, I know why Google and Apple have been weak relative to Meta. Well, now you know. There you go. Thank you for that. All right.
Yeah, yeah.
Now some people really do like to talk about why.
Yeah. So I also want to point interesting Felix's comment about the Mistral deal involving Microsoft, which is a, you know, potentially competitive large language model against ChatGPT, OpenAI. You know, remember what's going on in the antitrust context on that too. The US, the UK, and the EU are all looking at the relationship between Microsoft and OpenAI. Now, OpenAI has become this, you know, catalyst driver for people, you know, going into Microsoft. I understand that. But remember, they're very nervous about that relationship and the idea that if the platforms, the cloud guys own those large language foundation models, that they will begin to, you know, balkanize the availability of AI services and deployments going forward, and that's anti-competitive, et cetera. So, you know, they're not ruling out the idea. I don't know they'll do it. I don't know that the facts will support it. But they're not ruling out the ideas yet that they could go after that relationship. And if they did, you know, was it a de facto merger? Is there something anti-competitive in that relationship? I think that would really sort of, you know, shake people up out there in terms of the open AI investment thesis involving Microsoft. We'll see what happens, but they are investigating that from a competition policy and antitrust perspective. And maybe when you say, hey, look, we're providing other models for users, it's a way of making that relationship look a little more attenuated and reduce some of the antitrust risk in that investigation. I don't know that, but there's some logic in that speculation. Finally, I'll just say something. Yesterday, after almost 4 hours of oral argument at the Supreme Court, challenging state laws, Florida and Texas, that prohibited political censorship, content moderation, because to protect conservative viewpoints on big social media platforms like Facebook, like Google, YouTube, like Twitter X. I can tell you that the court is hostile to the idea of these laws regulating the content moderation policies of those big social media platforms. But as I said in the published note, it could still very well uphold those laws, not because they think they're legal, but because of the nature of the way the case was brought. I'm not going to get into all the details. There's not enough time. Facial versus as applied constitutional challenges. I'm not going to get into the constitutional law treatise on this, but it, the way you present that case, if there's a way that the state law might be constitutional in some applications, then bringing a general, this law is unconstitutional, no matter how you use it, type of case, which is what was brought, it becomes problematic because there could be some constitutional applications to other types of social media or digital platforms. So it's possible those laws could be sustained, even though as a substantive matter, they agree, I think, with NetChoice and the social media companies that moderating political content on a Facebook, on a Twitter X, on YouTube is unconstitutional. That's a mouthful. Read the note. But my point is, the state laws may dodge the bullet in this one, maybe not, but they could. And then that means that there'll be a future case that narrows the type of constitutional First Amendment claim being brought against those laws, and they would be struck down in that context and probably in a hurry. But there was some possibility that you're going to get a headline that says those state laws are upheld, and that would be deemed a negative catalyst for those social media players. But understand that that would not be an indicator that the Supreme Court agrees that you can regulate their content moderation the way these laws did. It's just that the case has to be brought in a different context. It's a procedural thing, technical thing, but there are constitutional doctrines that address this. So be ready for that. We'll have to explain it all if indeed it comes out that way, because I think the headlines could be very confusing to people. But generally speaking, as a substantive matter, what Florida and Texas did, I think the court will say is unacceptable under the First Amendment, but they may not, as a technical matter, be able to strike the state laws down at this juncture. Again, if it happens, we'll talk about it and clarify things for people at that time. So that's it for me.
Yep. If it sounds like a mouthful to some of you that you couldn't replicate, you're probably right. I mean, so Paul, for those of you that are new to this week, member of the Supreme Court Bar, so he obviously has got an intense legal background, and that's where he provides his legal edges. It's like kind of like when you're watching the NFL, JT, and you're looking for the guy who comes on and talks about the actual rules versus a bunch of screaming fans that are emotional about who's winning or losing that have no idea about the rules but think they do.
You mean, yeah. Taylor Swift? Oh, sorry.
Oh,
wow.
That he also moonlights as a comedian. But anyway, JT, we're in overtime here, and I do.
Yeah, we're in overtime, and I'll be really quick. I thought you were going to talk about yesterday. You were talking about watching the PGA and Knapp. That was quite a showing by him. First time I think I've ever watched 18 holes of golf on TV.
I like that guy. He's got.
I did too.
The guy's got his. He's got his grandfather's initials on his bicep. He's all about his, you know, family. He dates Canadian women. The guy's
Canadian
awesome.
Women,
got great hair.
Beautiful Canadian women. Unbelievable.
Nice. And she apparently likes his Canadian mullet. I mean, there's a lot to that guy.
He wobbled a little bit on the front nine, but then, man, he just kept it together on the back and was just so steely. It was amazing. Amazing to watch.
That's good.
Quick, we're out of time, so I'm just going to dumb this down for my purposes here. Meeting at the White House today, Biden, McConnell, Schumer, Speaker Johnson, and Hakeem Jeffries. Only person that matters right now, Keith, is Speaker Johnson. Whatever they decide in that meeting or don't decide, which I don't think they're going to come up with much, Johnson has to sell it to his caucus on the House Republican side, in particular the Freedom Caucus. If he decides to go with the Freedom Caucus, we're going to have a shutdown this weekend. If he decides to do what McCarthy did before him and what Johnson has done a couple of times now, then we're probably looking at another CR that takes us to mid-March. There's talk of somewhere between the 17th and the 22nd. Same holds true for foreign aid, and I think they're going to discuss that in the meeting as well. If he comes out of that meeting, Speaker Johnson says that I want to vote on Ukraine on the House side, that's where his speakership is in trouble. And moving forward, Ukraine aid and foreign aid at this point, that's where it gets dicier than the government shutdown and the spending bill. So we'll wait to see what happens in the meeting, see what the reaction is. But again, it all hinges on his really tenuous relationship with the Freedom Caucus guys and women who are really itching for a fight. I mean, everyone I talked to yesterday said that they want to shut down. If he listens to them, we're headed in that direction.
Wow. That's not priced into the market. Okay. Good to know. I'll see you guys on the Macro Show.
Don't forget to check out Hedgeye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @Hedgeye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by Hedgeye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the Terms of Service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.